The term self-study. This can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. To the student of theosophy, what we will hear today about self-study probably will find that we already know something about what this discussion is, and we have to give ourselves credit. We probably know more about it than we give ourselves credit for. As always, we're here to investigate ideas together so that we all might leave, all of us, with greater and deeper questions about self-study than we had before we came in here. This topic is as deep and as broad as the philosophy itself. And in certain ways, we could even say that self-study is the philosophy of theosophy. So hopefully, here we'll find that the bigger question is not what is self-study, but rather, what do we do with our own study of self to make it practical in our lives that we might be able to, that we might be the better able to help and teach others? Well, if we listen to Mr. Judge, what Mr. Judge has to say about it, it seems this topic is a pretty important one. He says, study all scriptures near and far. Worship all images and saints of the earth. But if you do not study who and what you are, then all your vast studies are of nothing worth. So, where do we start? Well, there are three prerequisites we've read, three issues, three conditions that are prerequisite for self-study, without which it can't be done. And the first is one's capacity for calmness. It's essential to find calmness within ourselves in order to produce, to pursue self-study. Self-study requires that we make a change in our mental habits. At least for a while each day. Without this change, no results can come from self-study. But we ask, why? Why this change? And it's said that because we may have the qualities that are necessary, we may have the right motive, we may have the conviction, the determination, but this is not enough. Placidity of mind and heart is required for the inner voice to be heard. Call that the voice of spirit, call that the voice of the silence, and to hear it. It doesn't speak to us in words. We have to be open to what that inspiration is. Now, second, anyone who is studying is in search of knowledge. Isn't that the case? No matter what we're studying, well, we must be in search of knowledge. But in the case of self-study, exactly what are we trying to gain knowledge of? Whatever it is, all that knowledge must be right here. It's always been here. It's going to be here our entire lives. But if we begin our search in ignorance of the relationship between the knower and the knowledge, then it's a waste of time. It's kind of like studying the flame of a candle without the candle. The flame doesn't make sense unless it has its fuel. The fuel is the candle. And the candle means nothing to us unless it's being used for its purpose, which is to provide light. So we have to understand the relationship between the knower and the knowledge. This is not an intellectual pursuit. The third prerequisite for self-study is to accept that no one can learn this for you. No one can do the work for you. No one can open up your inner doors that you've shut. Only you have the key to unlock those doors. This takes work. Work, it's like we have to develop muscles in that direction by practice. It has to be done according to one's own self-induced means and self-devised methods. We make our own tools as we go. Or perhaps we should say we develop or evolve our own tools as we go. Now, when the mind reaches placidity, calmness, undistracted by the external environment, and realize here to the inner man, the external environment to the inner man is our physical body. And all the things that are going on within it, the hormones, the emotions, and all of that. So, when the inner man reaches placidity, undistracted by external influences, the mind's default is magnetically attracted, magnetically drawn to make a connection with the heart. Or we could say with Buddhi. It's attracted upward toward Buddhi or inward toward the heart. The heart is symbolically a seat of the inner life, we could say, one's hopes, one's highest aspirations. When one may hold in one's heart the faith that we will succeed. To gain greater self-knowledge in this lifetime, that we might use it not so that we have greater knowledge, but so that we become more and have a greater understanding and can use that understanding in service to others, greater discernment, that we might have what the Gita says is greater skill in the performance of action. And when we read that in the Gita, skill in the performance, the real plane of action is the mind, skill in the use of our mind. Well, labels, forms, images, names, analysis, judgment. These all inhibit the exercise of the inner heart senses. Just as we have exterior senses that feed us information from the outside world, we also have interior senses that feed us information from within. Fortunately, The exterior senses have the tendency to draw our attention to this outside world to the point where we accept that this is the reality, the only reality, my permanent reality. And this is where we place all of our attention to the detriment of our inner life, to the point that it's even a fixation. Well, the human being has interior faculties and heart process and processes, our heart senses, which perceive an inner spiritual awareness. These faculties, these inner faculties, are aroused to action, just like our emotions or personal desires are aroused or evoked from within based on what our external senses detect, so too our internal senses are aroused to action. How? It's in proportion to the success that the individual makes to control his external senses. So the more we control or mortify or stop our external senses from affecting how we are, how we think, the default then is our mind goes within or above, however we want to see it. Mind is always in search of knowledge. Okay. Mind is always in search of knowledge. We talk about the perceiver. The perceiver is within. And let's use that word carefully for this talk. You know, we all find it very interesting that in the philosophy, we're told everything that happens about us that is sensed by our external senses is registered. We perceive it, and we have a permanent register. That makes a mark of it. Every thought, every action, every word we see, every sign we see, every discussion we have. Okay. So we perceive everything. Okay. Well, guess what? A rhododendron perceives everything around it too. It's not a big deal. It's going to happen whether you're paying attention or not. The question here is, are we observant? A teacher is observant when she watches the child work out his math problem at the chalkboard to see where he needs the correction. And because he's done his homework, but is having a problem, she can give an adjustment and everything's set, and he will know how to do that math problem forever. The student who never did his homework, doesn't matter how many adjustments the teacher tries to give him, he has no idea what he's doing. We know the difference. We have personal experience in that. But right, so the human being can observe. Lower kingdoms do not observe. If we're ignoring our outer environment, if we're suppressing it, the mind seeks more clearly the inner environment, and we observe that more clearly. Where we place our consciousness, there is the observance. Where there is observance, or where the perception is, that's what we can observe. Okay. So this is a problem. This is a challenge that's waiting everybody, waiting for everybody who pursues self-study. And there are obstacles that present themselves in these less familiar areas of ourselves. So we make the effort to focus our mind and our heart upon equilibrium to reach this calmness, to maintain this calmness. If we are devoted to the achievement of this objective, we will gain self-knowledge if and only if. We'll say that again. We will gain self-knowledge if we do all of this. We will gain self-knowledge if and only if we but express it in practical service. This is not beyond our power, as in the voice of the silence. We're told, now think of it, we're going to use the word nature here out of the voice of the silence. And in theosophy, the word nature is described as the infinite interactions and interrelations of all intelligences on every level, from the lowest gnat to the highest archangel. The intelligences, interactions, and interrelations is what nature is. There's great nature, and each human being has his own nature within him, with all of the intelligences within his being interacting. Okay, so in the voice, so the statement is, if we're devoted to achievement, if we're devoted to achievement of this objective, we will gain self-knowledge if and only if we but express it in practical service. And HPB tells us, help nature and work on with her, and nature will regard thee as one of her creators and make obeisance. And she will open wide before thee the portals of her secret chamber, lay bare before thy gaze the treasures hidden in the very depths of her pure virgin bosom. Now, there are no miracles. Reading this, contemplating this, it's like, that's a pretty big deal. But it's step by step along the way. It's a matter of learning along the way more about ourselves. And as we learn more about ourselves and use this, we could say this learning, probably better word to use this greater sense of understanding to help others. And you know, nature will regard thee as her creator. That's a way of really saying we're beginning an evolutionary process within the lives of ourselves. Nature makes obeisance. Nature responds to us, does what we call upon it to do. Now, don't get too technical. We all know that if we go to the gym and work out whatever set of muscle groups that we have, if I do this rep this many times consistently every day, the muscle is going to grow. Don't ask me about the biochemistry of it, but the muscle is going to respond. The body's going to respond, right? We have to accept this is the same. When we talk about metaphysics, English doesn't even have the words to describe what really goes on. Biochemists have the word to describe whatever goes on when the muscle grows, but we don't have those words in English. But it is the same principle. Do it, call upon it, use it for the right reasons, and these internal opportunities for growth and understanding will continue to unfold. The struggle for mastery over our personal desires arouses certain forces within us. In particular, it arouses the will. Gaining control of our lower nature arouses the will. Over time and with effort, the will has a stronger and stronger tendency to act upon the higher thoughts of man, and kind of leave behind the passions and desires. So, you know, we all have willpower. Some people say, oh, I don't have willpower. No, everybody has willpower. It's 100% present, infinite willpower. How do we use our willpower is the issue. Have we developed the faculties? Can't explain the little mechanisms of it, but the statement in the philosophy is that spiritual will is developed the more we try to control our lower nature. And this affects our higher nature. Or maybe the result is that our higher nature has a chance to come in and affect us more because we're open to it. We're creating the channels. We're making our brains more porous to the dictates of the soul because we're thinking in that right direction. So in time, essentially, we become free from the control of our passions and desires when we begin to control our passions and desires. The warning from HPB is be careful because in the course of life, if we don't control our personal nature, and she's talking to the inner man when she says this, if we don't control our personal nature, then our personal nature will grow and control us. That is the natural process at this point in evolution. That's what will happen if we don't do something about it. Okay. There's a statement that Krishna makes. The power of will consumes all actions to ashes. The power of will, and that has to do, and actions have to do with personal actions. Whatever we do, whatever mistakes we make, the power of will consumes all actions to ashes. And here's the statement in the Gita. Seek this wisdom, self-knowledge. Seek this wisdom by doing service, right? Like in the declaration to disseminate the fundamental principles and the exemplification in practice thereof. Seek this wisdom by doing service, by strong search, by questions, and by humility. The wise who see the truth will communicate it unto thee. And that doesn't mean somebody who knows more than you. It's the wise within you. The wise who see the truth will communicate it unto thee, and knowing which thou shalt never again fall into error, O son of Bharata. By this knowledge thou shalt see all things and all creatures whatsoever in thyself and in me. Even if thou wert the greatest of all sinners, thou shalt be able to cross over all sins in the bark of spiritual knowledge. Why? Because we learn from our karma. We don't get punished from our sin by means of spiritual karma. If we see the results of our karma as educative and we learn from it, then we grow more in many inner ways, whatever they may be. If we don't, that's okay, because it's going to come back around. And maybe next time we will. And maybe next time we will, whenever that may happen. But even if thou wert the greatest of all sinners, thou shalt be able to cross over all sins in the bark of spiritual knowledge, as the natural fire, O Arjuna, as the natural fire reduces fuel to ashes, the flame burns the candle to ashes, so does the fire of knowledge reduce all actions to ashes, all of our personal issues to ashes. There's no purifier in this world to be compared to spiritual knowledge, which is knowledge of self. He who is perfected in devotion findeth spiritual knowledge springing up spontaneously in himself in the progress of time. Two things there. He who is dedicated to working out finds that he becomes much stronger unexpectedly in the progress of time. It takes time. It can be months, it can be years, but the point is continue to do the work. So, okay, so we'll stop there for now and open the floor to any contributions and yeah, sure.
Early on in the talk, the word inspiration used. So it seems like the word inspiration kind of has the root spirit in it, does it not?
Doesn't it? So if you're right, so if one is inspired, the typical daily thing, I'm excited about this, it inspires me. But when we look at these teachings and think inwardly using our theosophical lenses, words matter in these theosophical works. The inspiration is from the spirit within, wouldn't it be? It would seem. Test for yourself. SL.
In the light of our overall theme, the path of spiritual evolution, who or what is it that is evolving spiritually, not only in this life, but through many lives, as a result of this individual self-study and meditation of this one, the basis of this personal one life?
Right. So who or what is evolving spiritually as we work this? Well, let's look at man in terms of really the animal man or the lower nature, which is controlled, the animal nature controlled by desires and passions. But then there's the higher nature, which is Atma Buddhi Manas, spirit, the wisdom, which is the vehicle of spirit and mind. By living our lives according to certain principles, we experience the world in ways that can be more worthy of assimilating into our nature. Now, what do we mean by assimilating into our nature? After each life, we go into a place of calm and of reflection. We can call this heaven or a heaven-like state. Theosophy calls it Devakan, which simply means the place of the gods. And here, we reflect on all of the higher thoughts and aspirations and experiences that we went through during the period, during the lifetime that we had just lived. And this time in this heavenly state gives the soul the rest it needs to incorporate or to assimilate all of the lessons that it can learn from our time in that physical life. The substance, it is said, the substance of soul is experience. Kind of hard to grasp, but our experiences are the substance of our soul. But careful, it's only the experiences that are worthy of being assimilated into the soul. make up the substance of the soul, of the higher nature. Now, there are other experiences that are not of that higher nature, that are just the effects of which, rather, the effects of which are just waiting for us to come back and to, burn with the flame of the spiritual self so we can leave the rest to ashes, right? But we're going to get the karma, right? So, the evolution is it's the edification of the ego. The edification of the ego. When, the process of evolution ends up at the source of evolution, which is all spirit, all wisdom, all knowledge, and the complete acceptance of consciously living in spirit, or that not the acceptance of, but we, ultimately the human being who is successful at doing this is consciously living in spirit, reaches that by working its way through evolution. And while the ego, while the monad was there to begin with, well, at the end of that period of evolution, it's back in the exact same place, but now it has all of the wisdom that was gained from all of the experiences. It's kind of like every morning that we wake up, we look forward to what am I going to do today? And sometimes there's this thing, oh, just another day I'm going to work. But we can also look at it, each day, are we being observant? Or are we just passive about it? The more observant we are, the more the day means to us, the more the day has meaning, the more we learn and gain in understanding, and the more we can put in understanding. Yes.
So the title of the class today is Self-Study and Meditation. So can we look at how does self-study assist us with meditation? And so is that how one meditates, is because we've looked at ourselves and have studied how we react to things?
Okay, so the question here is, what's the relationship of self-study to meditation? A prerequisite to meditation is that we're calm. How do we do that? There are those who may be able to maintain their calm at any point, any time of the day. They can go into a meditation as they vacuum the living room. They can turn that into a meditation. Some of us have a real problem with that. Some of us kind of scatterbrain, right? But we have to create, we have to make the decision, the personal decision, to create the conditions around us and within us. When we create the conditions within us, that's actually around the inner man. Remember, the external world to the inner man is our body. The external world to the outer, to the lower man, is the world. So we have to create a space that is safe, that is calm. And that can mean maybe first thing in the morning, before anything else, or any other time of the day that is right according to one's own schedule. That's first. But second, it has to be consistent. Why? Because we have to help nature, and nature will respond. And our nature needs a cycle. We need to set a cycle so that the life within us, or the lives within us, or the elementals within us, however we want to call it, get into the habit of responding to those conditions at that time of the day, in that place, when we begin, if we read this portion that we pick from the Voice of the Silence, okay? And as we do that, what we've read is that the space around us also has elementals. And the elementals in that space around us where we meditate, that space literally, we can't say literally, but it's almost like it goes into that mode and it comes to light. There's life all around us. So when we go into that place for the right purpose and make it the habit, it starts to work. Can't give you the in particulars, don't ask me how, but it does. And don't ask me how muscles grow when I work out, but they do, right? So that's all we can say, you know, just yes, in the back.
So we're mostly made out of water. And if we use the analogy of tides, like every day, if we set up a cycle, like there's a high tide, there's a low tide. So if we meditate, contemplate, do self-study every day at a specific time, it's like a tide.
Okay.
It's like a, and it really is a good analogy because it's mostly water anyway.
Okay. So the contribution here is we're using an analogy for the tide. And it is a perfect analogy. Why? Because the tide of the earth flows in relation to the moon. We can say it has to do with the magnetism of the moon or the gravity of the moon or the polarity of the moon versus the earth. But there is a cycle that causes the tide to flow in and flow out. So as was mentioned here, when we set this place and time and frame of mind, we're creating a cycle in which there's a tide where the lower nature is ignored, suppressed. It takes a while to do that if you're just getting started. That's a different conversation. We can go there. But when that happens, then the default is to reflect inwardly or upwardly to our higher nature and establish that that connection, you know, kind of widen the bandwidth of our relationship to our inner nature. And when we do that every day, the lives in nature, the nature in the room, the nature in ourselves, they become accustomed to it. These are the conditions that the inner man needs of equilibrium, calmness. That's worth thinking about. Okay, there's a chat. Let's see. Oh, okay, hold on. So we got, did PL have his hand up? No. JB, I'll be right with you. We're gonna go to the chat and then we'll go check. JB. So what's the best way to study the book, The Secret Doctrine? Because it's extremely difficult to understand. Fair question. After about a year, we came in, really, after about a year, we came in and said to the person at the book table, I said, you know, I read like three pages of The Secret Doctrine and I literally got a headache. And Joan sat, I'm not supposed to say her name, but it was Joan. And Joan stood there next to us and she says, ha ha, Tom got a secret doctrine headache. That's exactly what she said. Okay, so what's the way to study The Secret Doctrine? There's a lot to that question. The best way when a student is starting out, which is what we were told by the older student at the time, is definitely read it, but use it as a reference. If you hear something that's really important that you think that kind of strikes a chord in a theosophy meeting, go to The Secret Doctrine and pull it out. look it up in the index and go through that page or two or three. And while you're there, you're going to page here and there, and pages are going to flip open that are going to be really interesting. But that's up to you. Also, you know, flip to the page, just taking 20 minutes and reading the topics of the table of contents in The Secret Doctrine is fascinating. You know, I'm good for a month. You know, early on, I was like, wow, that's amazing. One day I'm going to know all of that. But so yeah, the proem. Yes, the proem is, okay, so what's the proem? The proem, so yeah, okay, we're talking about The Secret Doctrine. So why is the proem? So we all know, you know, books have a preface. Books have an introduction, the beginning. You know, one's by another person, the other's by an author. But a proem, you don't really see that anymore. A proem is kind of an introduction. It's actually more of a synthesis of a great classical work, which, you know, back when books were rare, and if you get this book, you better read it now because somebody, you don't get to keep it. Okay, a proem is a good amount of pages in the beginning of a book that gives the reader a sample of the breadth and width of this book and what it's going to cover. And if the reader is reading this proem and getting really into it, then he knows this book's for me. But if it doesn't open those, so to speak, channels in you that inspire, you know, then you know this book is a waste of my time. So it's not just a preface about, hey, I know the author, he's a really good guy, you should read his book. And it's not just an introduction. Well, I've been thinking about reading this book for the past 15 years, and finally, writing this book. I've been thinking about writing this book. No, the proem is a synthesis of what you should get out of this book. So you can cruise through the proem. That's in and of itself is a big work. Yeah. And okay, and we will say, should you choose to do that and decide not to read the whole proem, find the fundamental propositions in the words of HPV in the proem of The Secret Doctrine, which is like pages 10 to 14 or something like that. You'll find them. Yes.
It has been suggested to us that not to try and sit in the book from the beginning to end, but to pick a topic that we're interested in and go to the index and pull out the appropriate.
Yes, thank you. And so this student makes the emphasis, which thank you. It's probably not a book that you want to read from page one to page 1500. But pick a topic, research it, and have fun with it, because you will. You will. Yes, SL. Oh, wait, there was another. Was it JB? Yeah, JB, then SL. Yeah.
Yeah, so yes. Speaking of self-study and meditation, I wanted to bring up the diagram of meditation. I'm not sure what book that comes from, but it's something that HPB put together, which talks about perpetual presence and imagination in all space and time. And it starts by, you know, first conceiving unity by expansion in space and infinite in time. And then it has a list of acquisitions, things that we should mold our consciousness by, and then deprivations, refusal to think of reality in certain aspects. Is this something that we're familiar with, this diagram of meditation? And is it a tool that we can use to help us with the self-study?
Is this a tool we can use to help us with self-study? That's a great question. The literature that we use at the ULT is, of course, all from the writings as recorded in, is Theosophy as recorded in the writings of HPB and Judge. We're not saying that there aren't other articles and things that they wrote, but there's a certain purpose to the program of the ULT. That diagram, our first question, we don't have personal experience with that diagram, but our first question would be, How do I know that HPB wrote it? And if the student intuitively recognizes this is bona fide theosophy, that's fine. And if that helps in the pursuit of and development of meditation, so be it. That's great. But what you'll find here at the ULT, in the program of the ULT, we present the fundamental principles of the philosophy so that each student can take that and continue on their path wherever that brings them. And it will bring those who take that path to places where, you know, if this student, for instance, if this student was asked by a new person, all right, what's the best way for me to meditate? Well, for this student to actually know that, we would have to know the karma of his emotions. We would have to know the depth of his, we don't know all these things. That's why we stick to the principles and the individual. Now, does an adept, if you find an adept, sure, there are those in the world that could help. So we're not saying no, but that's not what ULT is about. We're not here to put forth, we're some kind of an authority on what you should do to be a more spiritual person. We're here to point to the teachings of theosophy and to go with it. So if it's known that this diagram is an HPB diagram, so be it, but we couldn't say. JCS, did you have your hand up? You didn't, okay. MDW, please.
Well, there are a few places in our studies that HPB and Mr. Judge give suggestions on what to meditate on. You know, HPB suggests that we meditate on the spiritual sun and the physical sun. And that contemplation will lead to greater understanding of our own nature. Mr. Judge, he always refers to the fact of, you know, meditating on going to each person you know and making connections with them, you know, and making, you know, just making connection, and that you spread this out. Another Buddhist meditation, or even, you know, is you take the moon disc and place it on your heart and you let it expand and expand till it fills, you know, the planet, the solar system, and beyond. And I think the purpose of those kinds of meditation are to develop in ourselves the abstract mind.
Thank you. Right. So when it comes to that diagram, there's no authority here. We don't claim specific knowledge on that. But if it helps, then it helps. Test it out. That's all we can say is test it out. But we could say, you know, we as students know that perhaps the quintessential, could we say, instruction manual, so to speak, for meditation would be Mr. Judge's translation, or whatever you'd use the word for. It's called Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. And it's in a little book about this big. It's in a little book about this big, but it's blue. And that will point us also in the right direction. Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms by Mr. Judge. SL, please.
Yes, just to go back to the chat for a moment regarding the best way to study the book, The Secret Doctrine. We thought that the three prerequisites to meditation could be applied here. For example, if we're going to study the secret doctrine, we have to first calm our minds, and we have to silence the senses, and we have to arouse the will and remember that the real secret doctrine is not in black and white on the page. It's really within, and it's within our intuition, and we have to arouse that. And so just as we have to prepare ourselves for meditation, self-study, we have to use the same method that was outlined in the talk to approach the secret doctrine.
Thank you. So when one does approach the secret doctrine in that sense, if we think of, thoughts and ideas are food for the mind, right? Salad and donuts are food for the body. You're going to eat salad or donuts. Okay. But we don't know in the body how that salad is turned into healthy energy. When we read the secret doctrine, we may not understand everything that's written there yet, but that inner man, that is healthy food for the inner man. The reading of the secret doctrine speaks to us two levels higher than where typically we are conscious of. And so that's something worthy of consideration. So put oneself in the same calm place, read it, learn what we can, and accept the notion that as we do, we're learning a lot more than we probably give ourselves credit for. So with that, we've come upon the end of the meeting. Hopefully, we all have bigger questions about self-study than we had when we first came in. And if that's the case, then together we've all fulfilled the purpose of the meeting, haven't we? Thanks for coming.